So welcome to another episode of the Neil Dammel Show. And in today's episode, I had the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Simon De Boer recently. Simon is a long distance cyclist, cycling strength and nutrition coach, and also founder of Velo Performance. He focuses on improving the long-term health and sports span of cyclists hitting 40 and above, and believes that with the right training, you can mitigate the age-related decline that most cyclists see from that age upwards. We had a really good, insightful conversation. As both cycling and health coaches, we discussed the topics of nutrition, strength training, and just rest and recovery within cycling, and how amateurs can utilize those methods to improve their performance, and some of the mistakes that a lot of amateur cyclists experience when it comes to trying to improve their performance on the bike, and tools to improve those and navigate around them to improve their cycling performance, and also just improve their cycling performance and enjoy cycling for as long as possible going forward as we age. So Simon himself is a really keen long distance cyclist. He's also done John O'Groats to Land's End recently on his own and covered that in 5 days. He also came in the top 5% of races at the Tour de Mont Blanc, and recently PB'd up Sacalabra. If you haven't done that climb in Mallorca, it's one of the bucket list climbs to do, in 31:33, which is a very, very good time. So if anyone's done Sacalabra, they would know that's not an easy feat. So big respect for Simon on that. But really good conversation. Going to get into it now. So you can follow Simon or reach out to Simon. All the links will be in the show notes, in the show notes for the podcast. But if you're enjoying the show, feel free to let us know. But without a shadow of a doubt, let's get into this week's show. Welcome to another episode of the Neil Dammel Show with your host, myself, Neil Dammel, founder of Dammel Coaching, bringing you simple and honest advice on all things cycling related, helping you to cycle faster and recover quicker. Plus, sharing my personal experiences on all things health, wealth and mindset. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode. Hi Simon, thank you very much for coming on to the show today. Just for everyone not aware of who you are, just give the audience a bit more of a breakdown, background of who you are, what you do, and you know, your involvement in the world of cycling.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having me on. As we were saying earlier, so I'm a keen cyclist. I do mainly long distance. So I started off doing road races and dabbling at crit races, decided that I wanted to keep my skin. As much as it was exhilarating and fun, I decided I wanted to do different things. So I started doing different challenges and riding big climbs and things like that just for fun. And then started getting into long distance cycling and making that bit more competitive, so either doing self-styled challenges or going to do things like Tour de Mont Blanc and bigger 200 mile rides and Milan San Remo and stuff like that. So that's my focus, but I still have a focus of trying to PB up climbs. So went to Mallorca this year after a good winter of training last year, and posted a very strong time up there, which I was happy with. And now I'm looking and thinking, can I get quicker? And that's boiling down to equipment and maybe slightly fractionally switching my training up. But my whole focus really is the long distance side of things right now. So next year I'm doing Inferno ride in Switzerland, which is 130 miles with 5,500 meters of climbing each day over 2 days. And then I'm going to do the Haute Route Dolomites. Plus, I'm going back to Mallorca. I do this every year. I go back to Mallorca and see if I can post a better time going around the island. Last year I did it in 10 hours and 40 minutes, and I think I can do that in 10 hours if I really think about it. So it's just like little personal goals for me more than anything else. And it's also to show people, I think, as you get older, so I'm 52, I'm going to be 53 in December, that with the right training and focus and nutrition and, you know, a bit of desire and consistency, you can actually still keep riding strong, looking strong. And that's the whole point of what I do. So I run a coaching business for cyclists, which is focused for people who are hitting 40 plus to get the best out of their training, nutrition, strength training. It's very much not focused on winning or doing racing. It's all about being the best you can be on and off the bike. So it's a little different angle from what other people do when they're coaching, because a lot of people are focusing on people to do things like road racing, TTing, and things like that. Yes, the guys and girls that I coach might do a road race, but we're not thinking about, right, we need to win. It's not about podium. It's about being in the best position and best physical shape to be able to take on that race and do the best that you can do. And that's the whole premise behind what I do.
Yeah. And were you always involved in cycling from a young age? Is that a sport you've always been passionate about? You dabble in other sports growing up as well?
Yeah. So like, let's go right back to early years. I live and come from Scotland, not that I sound like it. We lived in the middle of nowhere in a place called Kinross. So our nearest next door neighbour was literally 5 miles away. So the only way we could go and see our friends was to jump on a bike. Mm. So yeah, you could say we were pretty active from kids. And there's 6 of us. So our folks were not driving around everywhere. Bought us some really basic bikes from Halfords, and that's how we got around. You know, it was the only way that we could. So, you know, I have 3 brothers, and we played on bikes and we did crazy things and rode different places. So that's how I got into cycling, and I dabbled with it as a kid. Never really did anything serious, but just rode bikes. And then when I finished school, I decided. My father died very early on, and he said, "Look, go and do whatever you want in life, but whatever you do, throw yourself into it." So I became a racehorse jockey because we had ponies as kids. And I did that for 4 years and decided very quickly that I wasn't a very good jockey. If I blow my own trumpet, I was a good, decent horse person, but not a very good jockey. Then moved to London and started personal training and coaching. And was there for 10 years, cutting my teeth, you know, coaching people, training people to look better, feel better, and also focus on things like marathons and triathlons. And that got me back onto the bike, because I decided that I wanted to do Ironman and triathlon. And then I raced that fairly competitively for about 4 or 5 years. But my Achilles have really thickened up, and it's something that is, I think it's fairly genetic, because my twin brother has the same issue. He can run, I can't. So I can do a 5k and I'm fine with that, but if you ask me to do a 10k, I will probably break down. And I have tried and tested lots of different things, seen loads of different physios who've all said the same thing: you're very unlucky. Your Achilles are really thick and they don't slide in the way that they should do, and you're always going to have this problem. So I ditched the triathlon and decided that I'll stick with the bike. And so for the last 8 years, that's been my focus. And I love it. For me, it's a sport that gives so much from a performance perspective, but also from a mental health perspective. I was just chatting to one of the guys that I coach yesterday about this, and you know, we were chatting about how his training is going really well, and what I was doing in training, And he always laughs. He said, look, I look at your Strava and you go out and you'll go out in every weather. I said, well, that's not particularly true, but I will go out when it's safe. And even if the weather's not great, I'll go out because I will train and be specific. But I know that the value of getting out on a bike in the elements helps me unwind. And when you do a job, and you'll know this, when you do a job where you're supporting people and talking to people all day, every day, having that ability to completely switch off and decompress from chatting to people and being just present is quite a valuable thing for us to have. And I don't get that on a turbo. It's a training session, and I totally understand how good turbo training sessions are. But for me, getting outside completely frees me. So I will go and do hill reps in rain and hard efforts in rain. I refuse to do it in snow. I'll just put that out there.
There's a line that you can draw there. Yeah. While you're on that topic, do you feel that's a big pattern you see in clients that you work with? I know if I have my clients at the moment, you know, really stressful jobs. I live in London. I've kind of gone the opposite way to you, where I'm from Devon myself and moved to London. So, and obviously I know you're back in Devon now, but obviously they've got high powered, stressful jobs, and their only way of really unwinding is through cycling. But do you also feel sometimes there's an over reliance on that as well? That could be to the detriment of their progress in terms of fitness as well, because I know that sometimes challenges I've seen with my clients that can come up on occasions.
So as in, well, too much reliance on turbo training?
Just in riding in general, and obviously trying to be following a plan, but maybe diverting from the plan because they're doing swift rides with their friends, or just going out with their friends at weekends when maybe they need to rest, because obviously that's the only way of maybe unwinding and de-stressing. So.
Yeah, so I think, you know, this is the beautiful thing about coaching people, right? You know, when you actually start understanding people and you know what their work-life balance is and how stressful times can be, because sometimes, like everybody, we have normal weeks where everything's just in flow and it's fine and we can religiously follow a plan and we don't need to think about it. But when life gets tough and things, you know, really juggle, and it's something I've literally just done with one of the ladies that I coach yesterday, everything suddenly literally pivoted for her. And I sat down and said, right, okay, look, we know we need to do this, and this is where you're going next year. But right now, throwing this on top of you is a really bad idea. You're going to basically crumble, and something will give, and I don't want it to be you. So we juggled around her training to make sure that she's specific, but also has the flexibility to make decisions on her own. And also, I made sure that, just chatting to her because I know her quite well, so when you know, we know at the weekends you need to spend time with your partner. So it's like, this is religious. Every day, every Saturday, you have a partner day and it doesn't break. I don't care what happens. You must have some time for you. So yeah, I mean, I think sometimes people follow plans too religiously, and that's the great thing about having a coach, and you'll know this yourself. It's like, if you develop a decent relationship with the people that you work with, if you've educated them and supported them in the right way, they will understand your way of thinking, and therefore they'll be a bit more relaxed in their thought process. They, well, I can't do this today. I can slide it to tomorrow. I know Neil won't worry about it. I know Simon won't worry about it, because I'm choosing to do the right thing for my health, my mental health. And, you know, I think that's really important. And that's good coaching at the end of the day. It's just making sure people make good decisions.
Yeah. And with your training yourself, obviously you like to ride out on the bike all the time in all weathers. What's your relationship with indoor training? How do you utilize that yourself, but also prescribe that for your clients as
well? I do.
What benefits, so, pros and cons you feel?
Yeah, okay. So in the summer months and spring months, when the weather's decent, if I can get out in the morning and it's dry and the weather's good, I can, because I use power meters and everything else like that, I can go out and do my training sessions outside. I will always do that. I'll always go outside if I can. But in the winter months, when I know it's dark and cold, and, you know, so last year's a classic example, I'd I did a block of very specific training from the start, well, the end of October right through to Christmas, and then again from January right through to the first part of February, because I was going away for a week and I wanted to be in really good shape to post a decent time for when I was away in Gran Canaria, up some of the climbs. I wanted to be strong for that. So I had this goal in mind. So all the turbo training stuff that I was doing was very specific and grew over time. So my thought process on turbo training is that you repeat sessions and you learn from them and then you move on. I think a lot of coaches tend to think, oh, I need to make this interesting and can increase it all the time. And then there are cyclist athletes never really truly understand or learn what that session is creating for them is in terms of power output, cadence, all that sort of stuff. So it's like, well, you, if we do this, then you know that all the data coming back is actually giving us the right information that we need. So yeah, I 100% I use the turbo over the winter months because it's perfect. It's very specific. I can look at the data, look at the power, look at the heart rate, retest, test, test, and say this is working. So I use it specifically for winter training, but I also still get outside. So I'm religious with two training sessions a week on the turbo, and then everything else of that, if I can, I'll go outside.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing you can't beat than being out in the fresh air and enjoying the beautiful countryside on the bike, is there? So, you know, it's good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, being in the UK, though, we're just, again, because the days are short, winter months, it's, you know, it's tougher to juggle that. And again, I'll say this billions of times, turbo trainers are there for that time of year, right? You know, they're there to keep you fit and focused. And potentially, you know, your summer cycling is built over the winter. And I definitely disagree with people who say, oh, I just do long, steady miles over the winter. It's like, well, I don't think you're doing yourself a good service if you're doing it that way. So, yeah, 100% turbo is very effective.
What do you say? Would you see the biggest mistakes people making during their winter training, or if that some people don't even do as much training during the winter because they, you know, have had a big year on the bike in the summer and will just want to sort of ease off a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, again, it all really depends on where they are as the cyclist. You know, what history they've had, but let's just assume that they are relatively fit. I think the biggest mistake I see a lot of people going into the winter is they drop volume. And they either do too much intensity or not enough, and too much of the wrong kind of intensity training to develop an engine. So they never really grow from it. So they're just hitting the same stuff week in, week out, week in, week out, never actually asking themselves the question, is this working? Is it delivering the result that I want? And then the other thing I think a lot of people don't do, and they should, is they should hit the gym. You know, and I think they should be hitting the gym all year round, but... Yeah. You know, winter months is a great time to build power and strength. I mean, for the most part, I think the biggest issue is, especially people as they get older, they feel like they don't need to do so much intensity and they just ride steady everywhere. And if you look at the science and understanding of what happens to you as you get older, in my book, it's completely opposite. You need to be very specific. And you need to work on some intensity to make sure you don't lose what you had when you were younger.
Yeah. And essentially, you know, strength training plays a massive role in that. I'm a really big fan of it. And I really prescribe that with my clients. And obviously I can see you're very passionate. And from your, you know, social media and YouTube, you really sort of focus on that as well. How have you noticed the benefits of strength training? Obviously, you've come from a strength training background predominantly within your career. How have you noticed that particularly helping you in the world of cycling?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I think it's that compounding effect of consistently doing it over time. And obviously, I'm tweaking things and learning new things all the time. So I think with the strength training that I've got, especially for the long distance side of things, when things get tough, so if I go and, you know, go and ride 200 miles on a ride, what I've noticed is in the in the latter stages of that 200 mile, I'm still able to hold good power. My heart rate's low and I'm super efficient. And it almost gets that feeling when I'm riding the longer rides, after 100 miles, I feel like I've just kind of warmed up. Even though I'm still riding strong in the first 100, second 100, I'm in my groove now. And I think that, yes, it's down to what I do on the bike and in the training and how I'm eating and feeling. But 100%, I'll say what's made the difference over the last 3-4 years is that compound effect of just consistently hitting the gym and doing the work on that front. When it comes to power, last year I decided that I'd switch a few things up, and I'm switching a few things up again this winter. But last year I decided I'd put some plyometrics in, so I wanted to try and hit the short twitch muscle fibers and be a bit more reactive. And I think, along with all the specific training I've been doing on the bike, that's helped me push better power for shorter distances. So again, you know, cracking up Sarco Labra in 31 minutes and 33 seconds at the age of 52, that's, you know, it's not a bad time. And I put that down to bike training as well as strength training and the plyometrics, because it just allows you to put you in that headspace that you can, and it also puts you in that physical space where you can really delve deep if you need to.
Yeah. Is there real research now coming out about those more high intensity efforts? So it was in the gym and sort of really heavy weight but low reps, in terms of really, you know, focusing on power, because that will also contribute to strength as well, because a lot of people will probably feel that just doing, you know, the typical 10 reps or 3x10 is going to be sufficient, but obviously it's not going to really grow and improve their muscle mass and explosive power as, I suppose, in a more linear, sort of consistent way.
The biggest path of resistance I see is people, as they get older, feeling like they, you know, need to maybe do slightly less or more yoga-y style body weight training. As much as that will condition you, it won't give you the desired response. You need to, if you really want to be in great shape as you get older, you need to work the muscle in a way that's going to stimulate it to be strong. And a lot of people maybe listening to this might disagree, or may feel really like that's not what they've been told. But when you, again, and you're right, when you look at the science, if you really think about how the body works and how over time we degrade as we get older, then by training the muscle that we know, so short twitch muscle fibers, in a way that we can regain that back and mitigate any decline over time, requires you to lift heavier, requires you to do a bit more reactive work, and body weight work just doesn't cut it. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm used to say put that in as auxiliary, so do some yoga style training and things of that nature. Some Pilates, definitely great. But if you really want to see changes in how you are in your physicality, you need to be lifting heavy and you need to be lifting reactively. And I'll say it billions of times to the people that I coach. So some of the guys that come on board who've never done strength training have posted their fastest times ever up places like Alpe d'Huez. And they will all say, yes, the training they did in the bikes worked, but the strength training has been a game changer in their ability to really delve deep. Plus it also makes you look good, right? You know, and that's the other thing I talk about a lot. It's like, you know, I'm 52 and I'm, you know, I'm in good shape, and I you know, good muscle tone, and makes you look younger, makes you move younger. And if you move younger, you think better, you just feel better all round. So, you know, the benefits of everything off the back of it is huge. And this is the whole thing about Velo. It's not just about riding bikes. It's about being in your best shape that you can be and ride bikes. You know, so ride bikes, fun. Let's be in good shape.
Yeah. Well, you certainly don't look, you know, your age, Simon, so I must congratulate you on that.
Thank you. I'm trying to ward that off for as long as I possibly can.
That's it. I mean, I've turned 40 last year, so I know I'm in that phase now of really focusing on.
I'll swap your ages.
Managing your body. So, but what resistance you find with strength training do you get with a lot of your clients? Because I still see in the industry, especially around, you know, I've come from a triathlon background as well and done similar events to you, where majority of the time that's just like a bolt on to someone's program around, you know, the other discipline. So how do you feel this could change within the industry? Because I still feel there's a lot of resistance when it comes to, oh, it's going to make me heavy on the bike, or it's going to weigh me down, or it's going to make me slower, carry more muscle, or these, you know, limiting beliefs or sort of other old wives' tales of what might be the negative aspect of it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think you've hit all the points on the head. It's like, you know, you think with all the new information coming out, and we're lucky, and this thing is, like, you and I probably read up on these things, and we're actively looking for what's working, what's right, what's not. Whereas other people are reading maybe media-driven articles which are contradicting weekly, and, you know, maybe looking at feeling a bit confused. So there is still the old dogma flying around that strength training makes you big and bulky, lift a weight, and a week later you look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And, you know, it's just simply not the case. And I think that's really hard to get across to people. I think cyclists are, regardless of whether they are doing it to post great times or race or even just for recreational purposes, they're worried about the weight side of things, which they needn't be. And again, I'll say, billions of times, the stronger you are, the more effective you are at being able to put out power, ride your bike faster for longer. Yeah, you know, your muscle density changes, so you feel like you're fuller, you feel like you're heavier. But, you know, if you're training well, eating well, and you change your body composition and you have more lean muscle mass, it makes you look good, makes you ride better. And it's down to you and me and everybody that understands what's important for people to focus on to keep just banging that good drum. And, you know, I see what you do, you see what I do, and we're talking the good talk and trying to educate people in the right way to think about how to train properly.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And how did that change for you going back to, you mentioned earlier that you were a jockey, so obviously it's quite a weight-driven sport alongside cycling as well. How did you manage your body, and was there a lot of restrictions on getting your weight down at the time? Because obviously I've not ever been a jockey, but seeing a few documentaries, jockeys, and it's very demanding sport. So
it's very demanding. And I, you know, I look back on when I was 20, you know, started at the age of 20. If I knew what I knew now, I'd have probably been a better and effective jockey from the nutrition side of thing as well as from a training perspective. But, you know, back then, no one really, you know, we were all on the fly. No one had any coaches. No one really understood, you know, anything on what was what. So we never did any strength training because we were worried about getting bulky or putting on any weight, any kind of weight. And yeah, I mean, I've thought about this loads of times over the years. Look back from what I know now to what I knew back then. Blimey, I was completely clueless at the age of 20. Had no idea. I was just making it up as I went along. My nutrition was horrendous. So yeah, it's chalk and cheese. I would if I could go back and chat to my past self, I'd say you need to change this, and this is why.
Did you have to get? I mean, what did you do? Was it flats or?
I was jump and flat, so okay, I had to be super light. Yeah. So I was roughly about 8.5 to 9 stone. Yeah. It was just crazy, right? And if you see pictures of me when I was back at that age, my arms and my legs looked like bedposts, you know, really skinny. You could see my knees, my kneecaps. Yeah. Not attractive and definitely not healthy. But again, you know, the thing that people were talking about back then is you need to be light. That's what you need to do. So I was eating, you know, white fish and spinach, most meals, Weetabix with water and pretty much like anything that was low carb, just to try and stay as light as I could. And I was, but I was hopeless on a horse. When you actually asked me to push hard in a race, I literally had no energy to do it. I would hope the world of the racing industry has improved, and their understanding of and knowledge on nutrition has changed for the better. I'm glad I'm not like that.
Do you feel that's changing also in the world of cycling now because of the science that's around it? And I was chatting to someone last week where if you look at a lot of the top riders now in the tour, they look like athletes now, don't they? Carrying a lot more muscle mass. It's not just about just losing weight and that's benefiting you. It's really being tailored to the discipline they've got within the role of the sport.
Yeah, I think, Neil, to be honest, I think at the top end level, you just need to look at all the top guys right now. They do look completely different. And they're posting, people will say, they're definitely on drugs. But I don't think so. I think they understand the data and the nutrition science so much more that they are using everything within their power that they can do under the regulations to be the best they possibly can be. And when you have that knowledge and understanding from coaches, nutritionists, great things can happen. And that's, you look at their body shapes. Yeah. They're strong and powerful. I think that's definitely changed at the top end. But I think as it filters down into the sort of recreational cycling, and maybe not so much. There's still, again, that people will read maybe some dodgy articles from dodgy websites, some social media posts which are a bit clickbaity. I bet you do, like I do every week, you'll see something coming through and think, this is so outdated now, we need to think differently. So I think people read these things and go into their own research, and it's not founded by science or any kind of experience from the people writing it. It's just good, it's just good article writing that sounds interesting and compelling. But ultimately I think this is where people make mistakes, and that's where you and I come in. That's where we go, well, actually, this isn't really backed up by the evidence that you're potentially reading. And if we change this will change for the better. It'll revolutionize your cycling.
Do you also feel there's an aspect with people just sort of jumping from program to program because they see that, there's a video come out or an article about, I should do more VO2 or more zone 2 or more weight training. So then they go, I'll just do this more, that rather than being consistent with one consistent plan.
Yeah,
it might not be so exciting on paper, but will deliver the results in comparison.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people don't understand periodization, and yes, they're probably very guilty of watching a GCN video, thinking, well, they're talking about zone 2 now, and now they're talking about I should be doing VO2 sessions, and then 2 weeks later they're talking about how we should only be doing zone 2 and zone 4 sessions. And the next week it'll be, let's do a block of sweet spot. Now, all of that can work, but where do you place it? When do you place it? How do you place it? Should you? Where are you as a cyclist? Do you have the condition to do any of this kind of training in the first place? So it's really tough to get that right. And I think people cherry pick stuff all the time. Or they just, to keep following the same thing week in, week out. And nothing ever really actually hits the mark. And again, it's just for us. That's where, I'll say it again, that's where we come in. We unpick it and go, no, this is what we need to do. So there are things that I do as a staple diet of training. There might be different variations of, because I'm trying to do something different with it. But, want to be a decent hill climber. You see this in some of the reels and stuff that I put out. So want to be a decent hill climber, you need to work and do hill climbs. If you're expecting to do 1 minute on, 1 minute off efforts and then go and ride up a hill at maximum effort for 10 minutes, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
You need to really think about what you're trying to achieve and train for that specificity. And then actually, there was a reel I did yesterday as I was climbing up to see hill reps yesterday. I was saying, I talk about consistency being the important thing, and I'm pretty sure you probably do with the guys and girls that you coach. But specificity, trying to get my words out, married with consistency is what we need to be focusing on. And, you know, I'm a big believer in that. I get people all the time saying to me, oh, don't you get bored of doing that? I'm like, well, no, because the outcome is by consistently doing what I'm doing in my training with different variations of it, it's allowing me to stay strong and fast on my bike. So that mental aspect of saying, yes, okay, I'm doing this in training and I'm consistently religious with it, but it works. And I think people get bored and lose sight of what they're trying to achieve, and they want things to be interesting. And, you know, it's like, well, sometimes training's not interesting. It just needs to be, you know, done religiously, and good things happen. It's like people just cherry pick stuff because they get bored, and that's generally why they never move further on with their ability to ride their bike harder, faster, longer, better average paces, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Hey there, fantastic listeners of the Neil Danwell Show. We hope you've been enjoying our episodes as much as we have been enjoying making them. We have a quick little request for you. If you could take a moment to leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform, it would mean the world to us. Your reviews help us reach more people and continue to grow. Plus, if you have a friend who you think would love the show, please consider sharing it with them. We're all about building a wonderful community of listeners, and your support makes it happen. Thanks a million. Now back to the show. And how did the training for you vary? Obviously, I saw that you did a really good time at Sakalabra recently, but then also you did John O'Groats to Land's End.
So yeah.
Two different styles of riding in terms of training, you know, for both essentially.
Yeah, but
how did you marry the two, and how did that work leaned up to both of those?
I knew I was going to Mallorca for 6 weeks because I run camps out in Mallorca, and I knew I was going for 6 weeks at the early part of the year. So through the winter, I worked a lot on VO2 work and worked a lot on slightly over threshold work in my hill climbing over long distances. So I was doing 10-minute efforts above threshold, cracking up hills through the winter, plus some VO2 work. So I knew I needed to raise that aspect. I was hitting the gym, and I was doing a lot of pure strength work and reactive strength work. So again, you know, at the age of 52, I knew that I need to address the fact that I'm losing my short twitch muscle fibers and its functionality. And by doing that in the gym, brings it right back into the fold. So over the winter months, I put that into play, and I basically had a periodized plan which would grow it. So when I hit Mallorca, I was in the best shape I could possibly be. And then at the weekends, I am religious about riding steady. So I'll go out with the guys and they'll go trashing into signposts really hard, which is fun. And don't get me wrong, occasionally I would go in, but with always a mindset. So I go and have a bit of play with them, but always a mindset that not too much. And also if they did start getting a bit silly from a long, long way out, I'd just sit on the back of them. So you can ride along in a group in zone two while they're trashing along. And I'm still traveling along at maybe 25 miles an hour, but my heart rate is low, my power is low. I'm just getting pulled. And I was very religious for that because I knew I wanted to keep myself fresh, growing that aspect of my fitness. So latter part of last year, I was focusing on that. And then after Mallorca, I changed the focus a little bit. So the strength training stayed the same. Interesting enough, I didn't change that at all. I still feel that from a physicality aspect of training, especially to get older, you need to be able to be training through the range of strength training and reactive strength training just to maintain it. And I think you should be religious with that all year round. But I started adding a lot more volume in and doing a little less power work. So my VO2 stuff dropped because there was no way I could do that volume and then do really hard VO2 and hill rep stuff. There's no way I could do it. I need more recovery time. I know that as I get older. So I kept with my threshold hill reps because that's relatively easy to do, not particularly time consuming. And I knew that just tapped into the engine that kept me strong and fast. And then everything else was as voluminous as I could make it and pretty steady. And that saw me in good shape to get to Landsend Groats and, you know, feeling ready and you know, happy to take that challenge on.
Yeah. Has that been a challenge that you've had in your mind to do for a long time? Have you done Stona Groats to Landsend before that? Obviously, you did it.
No.
As a solo ride.
So, no, it was one of those tick box things that I've always thought about doing and was always reticent of doing it in the UK because it's always miserable weather. And I'd done Tour de Mont Blanc the year before that. I'd done Milan-San Remo. I'd done a couple of self-styled crazy events where I was doing 200 miles. The Southwest Sportive Challenge that I set myself, which was riding Southwest Sportive in Devon. So each ride was about 110 miles with close to 11,000 feet of climbing in it, back to back for 5 days. And I did 100 miles every day for 100 miles a day for 10 days for charity in Mallorca for fun. And just, that was sort of like, what does that feel like? You know, if you ride at a certain pace and power every day, how does that feel like? And then someone said, well, you should really do Land's End to John O'Groats. And I never really fancied doing it over a longer distance of time, partly because of what I do for a living. It's quite indulgent to take all that time off and not really focus on anybody except for yourself. And also, by setting yourself a time frame of 5 days, it makes it a proper challenge. You're riding close to 200 to 230 miles a day. And you have to start and finish at designated point. And I thought, well, actually, that's quite a that's a good challenge. You know, most of the things I've done have been shorter than that. And with my understanding of training and where I am as a cyclist, is that something that I could complete in the time that I think I can? And one of my great mates, he and I have done some fun stuff together. And we do crazy stuff on a bike together. He's similar age, so he's a runner and a cyclist. We sat down over a beer one evening. Every time I turn to his wife's house, his wife goes, "Could you guys just go away, please? I don't want to hear what you're up to." He said to me, "I dare you to do it in 5 days." And I think, because I know him really well, I was like, "Okay, let's do that 5 days." And it was, for me, one reason why I never really wanted to do it in the UK is because of the weather, and the weather wasn't great to me. It wasn't really kind at all. And I think, that's why I'm doing everything abroad. From now on, I want to choose better weather. That's a challenge in itself. And it's only after I've done it, I realize physically I was in really good shape. What I had never really considered at the time was the sort of like other aspects to do with, so I, my nutrition and everything was good, but I got really bad saddle sores. And that's partly because my bike setup was fractionally wrong and I got wet. And I'm really hot on this with the people that I coach. It's like, get your bike fit sorted out. Really understand whether it fits for you. And I was fractionally too high on the saddle. And when I got wet, the shearing from the chamois and onto the saddle just created horrible saddle sores. So on the last day, I had to pretty much ride out of the pedals, other when I was filming for YouTube, out of the pedals. So the last day was, 160, 70 miles, the shortest day. And I pretty much rode that standing up. It was horrendous. And yeah, so those aspects, I think, really play in or really bring into the fold how tough that sort of challenge is. And the thing that I think I found really tough was I couldn't sleep well on the event. So, and neither could the guys that were supporting me. So the way that I did it was I had a support crew with me who, you know, designated spots we stopped and filled up with water and just cracked on. So these guys were working hard, and it's amazing how quickly you cover ground on a bike. They always thought that they could have more time to sort of like, you know, see sights and stuff. They never did. They were always on the go. And my sleep patterns, which aren't best or haven't been the best for best times, they now are good. But on the event day, I probably didn't sleep that much at all. I probably had maybe a couple of hours of sleep every night. By day five, I was mentally, I was having to play games to stay awake. So I was going, I apologize to anybody that I went through towns, but I was singing out loud to anything I could possibly think of at the time, just to try and stay awake. And I'm traveling at pace as well, you know, so you read it and you hear people saying, oh, when you do these long distance events, you know, struggling with trying to stay awake is quite hard. And you think, well, it can't be that hard. You're riding a bike. Surely riding a bike's not going to stop, make you want to sleep. That's the first time I've ever experienced riding a bike at 20 miles an hour along a road, thinking, I can actually just go to sleep here. I'll be fine. It was so that those things I didn't expect. But for the most part, you know, physically, I find there's never a time that I ever felt that I couldn't push the pedals round and do the paces that I wanted to. It was just those unexpected, uncomfortable feet, backside, lack of sleep aspects that I struggled with. You know, it's one of the, I think it's, and I was chatting to my mate who he and I have done these thing. So he did this year, so not to be outdone by me, he decided that he'd go and do the Bob Graham challenge in the Lake District, where you have to climb all the way or you have to walk all these different mountain passes, and you have to do it in 24 hours. And we both agree that it's not actually the physicality after a while that gets you, it's your attitude to how you deal with it. So when things go wrong, not chucking your toys out the cot's really important, and finding positivity and stuff that works. And you need to have a really good why of why you're doing it. You know, you can't just do these things on a whim. And I think that's all part and parcel of the challenge. And this is the cool thing about coaching people that have done these sort of things and helping them understand the mental aspect is possibly the most important bit to overcome. The one thing I always say to people is I think I'm probably a bit stupid, because if I go and do these things, I switch off from everything that's filtering that may be quite negative, and I just focus on just turning the pedals round. It's like eat, drink, turn the pedals round. If you do that, good things will happen, you know. Yeah. And if you get punctures or brick tires, it's like fix it, back on the bike, you know. So the mental aspect's a massive thing for long distance. People said, "Will I do it again?" And the answer is like no.
No,
not in the UK, that's for sure. I'll do it.
Which, what way did you go? Because I know I did the ride across Britain years ago, and that was from John O'Groats to Land's End, but that was 100 miles a day for 10 days, so it took in a longer route to be less direct, I suppose. So
we went from Land's End to John O'Groats, and you sort of like skirt around Wales, and then up past Glasgow and into Inverness, and then up to John O'Groats from that direction.
Yeah. So you stayed predominantly off main roads and
more lanes. Yeah. When we looked at the route, we decided, I mean, you can go a much more direct way if you want to, but you know, I got run over at the start of the year. A lady broadsided me, and not, I'm lucky still be in one piece. And we decided that we would choose routes that were off the main road. So the total riding distance was 960 miles. If you can, you can shorten that down to about 720 if you go a bit more of a direct route. But yeah, you know, off main roads, and it was amazing. Some of the roads we went up were just stunning.
Yeah, yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, and what did your nutrition look like? Was that a struggle for you, like trying to maintain that for that distance?
No, because I've done this for a fair time now. I think I've just refined it over time. I'm very much aware of flavor fatigue, and it was mixing things up. If you see any of my YouTube videos when I've ridden around Mallorca on the islands and I stop and get food, there's some religious stuff I do. So I make sure my hydration is on point with water and electrolytes. I aim when I'm doing these sort of events to hit anywhere between 90 to 110 grams of carbohydrate per hour. And that can be between energy chews, energy mix, energy bars, and I just vary it around. But I know what I need to be having each hour, and I'm hitting that mark. And then the other thing, I think, I say this a lot, it's like real food is the important thing. So if you ride long enough, you can eat all these bars and energy bars, and they help. But there is a point where you just need to eat real food. So the guys that were supporting me, we would look at where we were stopping over the day and try and figure out whether supermarkets were, if there was nothing, because we were going in the middle of nowhere for a fair bit, they'd either buy food or, they get pizzas, or they'd go to Marks and Spencer's and get sandwiches and, things of that nature. So there was always a food stop that you could stop and fill your pockets up with the right energy bars and mixes, but you could also have a proper meal if you fancied it. And I think that's a massive change. A lot of people don't do that. They think they need to have sports nutrition. You do, and you can't, I'd like to see anybody do Land's End Stornoway Groats in the time that I did, eating cheese sandwiches all the way around. It's not going to work. But you still have to have that element of, I need to have some decent food, some real food in me. It makes a massive difference.
You just crave more savoury food as well, don't you? Because literally most sports stuff is sweet. And
yeah.
Do such a long distance, you've had so much in your gut, you just want some salt and some
stuff. I totally agree, and what's really cool at the moment is that a lot of companies are realizing this now, that a lot of their stuff they've created is sweet, so they're now coming out with neutral flavors or slightly even sour flavors to combat the sweetness of some of the stuff that they've created, which is really good. But again, you've hit the nail on the head. One of the things, the two things that I really fancy when I go and do this, it's weird, is a cheese and ham sandwich always wins. And bizarrely enough, I quite like prawn sandwiches, which is weird. You ride at it really played on my mind on the last 2 days. And I was saying to Andy and Liz, it's like, if you pass a Waitrose or anything like that, get me a decent prawn sandwich, not a crappy porn sandwich, but get me something that's really nicely made. And it made me chuckle on the last day, because we stopped at one of the planned stops, and there were prawn sandwiches and all laid out for stuff. So I started eating them, and Liz walked around the corner and said, "Oh, those are mine." I'm like, "Well, they're not now."
That's so good.
I did share them with her. I'm not mean.
Yeah.
But savory and just weird things that run through your head sometimes when you're doing these things. Just like, and it's something I say to people when they do Ironman and things like that. It's like, that nutritional win at a certain point in a race could be the difference between you having a good mood and a really bad mood. I've seen people really lose themselves because they couldn't get a Coke, favorite energy bar or chocolate bar isn't at a certain point. And I get it. I understand why too. If you do something like big long events, those little small wins make a huge difference from a psychological perspective.
Yeah, as when I did the ETAP, and I don't eat much in the way of meat, but there's the salami sandwiches halfway up one of the final climbs, and that was glorious. Nice, at least a bit of rest and recuperate before you had to finish the climb. Yeah, but yeah, so. Anything you can do just to get some nutrients in and food in, you're just craving anything at that time, aren't you? So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, number one, calories are important. If if you can't get what you really need, if they've got food in front of you, eat it. You know, it's just, you need energy. You can't ride a bike at pace and not eat.
And what was the longest day on that one in terms of when you started? Were you starting pretty early before the sun came up? Did you ride during the summer period? We had
in the summer period. Yeah, so we did in the summer period, and the longest day I rode was day 3, which was 235 miles. And that was going into Glasgow. And I got a bit lost going into Glasgow. Garmin started to lose its mind a little bit as going through town. And I think I hit 226 miles, and I had 10 miles to go. And I had to stop and not get angry because the Garmin wouldn't play. And the annoying thing was is that everything, because I'd ridden 230 miles and not powered everything up, so my phone was dying. My Garmin was dying. I knew kind of where I was going, but I needed that directional sort of like pinpoint, because what happens with Garmin is that they suddenly lose everything and they never get it back. And I felt myself losing my sense of humor for a little bit. And I was like, no, you can't do this, because you need to get to your rendezvous point, and you need to do it in the next half hour. You need to get there. You're just going to get some food. Luckily, good old Strava. I basically cycled for 30 minutes with Strava on, and it directly got me to the hotel.
What advice would you give people doing that kind of distance if they've not done that kind of distance before? Maybe a sportif of 130 miles, but looking to maybe extend that, do like a one-day event. Any advice in terms of creeping into the realms of ultra distance?
I think basically pacing, get that right. You know, I think a lot of people think that when you go and do these big events, I remember doing the Dragon Ride in Wales, about maybe a year before COVID. My great mate Calvin and I decided to do it as a pair. And we set off and we knew what we were going to hold as in terms of power. And these people came past us like scalded cats. And we were like, well, these guys got to ride 200 odd miles up some pretty chunky climbs. They're either a lot better than we are, or they've properly got this wrong. And it took us a little moment for us to just go, no, we know what we're doing. Just let them crack on. So we rode to our power, and we just let everybody do what they want to do. We found them again about maybe 120 miles in, all cooked, every single one of them. On the side of the road, some of them were crying, saying, I can't finish, this is too hard. You went way too hard to start off with. So pacing and understanding that you need to be conservative over longer distances is really important. And then figuring out how to do your nutrition and be religious with it. A lot of people mess that up. They don't respect it enough, and they follow strange nutritional protocols because they've read someone told them that they needed to do X, Y, and Z. This is not rocket science. You need to eat the right foods, the right amount of carbohydrate to keep those pedals turning around. If you get that right, good things happen.
Yeah. I was just the same when I did the Dragon Ride. I didn't do the full Grand. I did the Grand Fondo, not the bigger, the dragon ride itself, the big one. But it's just really on the climbs, and it just really pacing yourself and seeing, just being comfortable in what pace that you want to maintain to be able to feel that you can still get to the end in one piece and not, crawling across the line. Yeah.
I think, the more I do this, the more I realize a lot of people tend to ride to ego, and there's a time for that. There's also a time for where you need to be really conservative. So if you're doing a shorter distance, you could probably ride to ego a bit more, especially if you trained well, you could probably dare yourself to push yourself that fraction a bit harder. But when you're doing longer distance and the ultra side of things, you need to be able to really stand up to that ego to yourself and say, no, if I do that, it's not going to go the way I want to. And Calvin said to me before I left to go and do Land's End Storm of Greats, he turned around to me, he said, I know what your problem will be. On the first day, you're going to go too hard. That really stuck with me, actually. And he knows me quite well. And you know, like everybody else, maybe get a bit enthusiastic on the first day. But I knew 960 miles is a long way to do in 5 days. So I didn't. And you know, it's like, okay, I was lucky I had a tailwind and I traveled quite quick. But if you look at my power, it was exactly the way it should have been. I think that's the biggest mistake people make, is just go way too hard.
Yeah. And what do you see within the nutrition side of things of mistakes that most people make? Not necessarily just, I would say, in training and when they're doing an event.
I always think that hydration is something people don't get right. You know, if they get the carbohydrate intake right and their total energy intake right, they should be okay. You know, and they need to be religious with it on the hour. So they need to know what they can consume and actively digest and feel comfortable with. Some people can handle 60, some people can handle 90, some people can handle way above. So, I can handle about 100 to 110 grams of carbs per hour, maybe even a little bit higher than that. Mm. I think that's the thing that most people get wrong, especially if they want to travel faster. In training, I think a lot of people don't think about how to fuel their working day. And I think a lot of people, and cyclists are terrible for this, they want to get as light as they possibly can. And they eat like dieters who aren't doing a lot of training. So therefore, they're driving very hard on a calorie deficit, not eating a lot of carbohydrates, because carbohydrates make you fat, right? Even in a massive calorie deficit. And then they wonder why they can't turn the pedals around. And they wonder why they're not able to hit the numbers and why they feel tired all the time. And I think the educational aspect of that and trying to help people relax around food is really hard. And cyclists are terrible for it. Even now, you know, and I think, you know, there's a lot of misinformation and confusion on that front. And there's the thing, you know, how you eat for sports and performance is, in my mind, very different from how you need to eat if you just want to lose weight and change body shape and body fatness. You can't work hard in training and expect to run off half a tank. It's never going to work. You can push, but you need to have a coach that understands how to do that and when to do it, and be flexible in their thinking and their approach to it on a day-to-day basis. And it's not something I regularly do with people, unless, of course, they really have to hit a weight target because it's going to help them get a better result in what they're doing.
Yeah. I suppose it's understanding a lot of people miss or confuse themselves with underperforming during a training session based on their own inability to ride strong, when aspects of that could be predominantly just they're not fueled well prior to the event or leading up to that session, and then just not having the glycogen stores to be able to put out the watts, the power that they're going to try and aim for.
Yeah, you've hit the nail right on the head. And I think people make this mistake week in, week out, and they always dial into the training. So they will always say, well, the reason why I haven't got here is because the training's wrong. Let's look at your nutrition and how you hydrate this properly in the lead up to it, and what your rest patterns are like and your sleep patterns are like, and ask yourself, have you done everything you can to make sure that you can hit that session in the best possible shape? Most people that fail this are either misinforming the coach about what they're eating because they're desperately trying to lose weight, and not achieving that, and therefore not hitting their goals in their training, or they're just really not paying much attention to it. And it is a big aspect of being, if you want to ride fast and strong, you need to eat well. To change weight and ride fast and strong, you need to have patience, and you need to set a time frame and saying, by this date, I need to be here, and you need to work on it quite slowly. And, you know, that's quite hard for some people to take on board.
Yeah. And I suppose it's just a self-awareness as well within yourself, because I know myself, I train a lot in the mornings, fasted for certain sessions, but I went to do an FTP and I didn't have any breakfast, fasted, and just during the warm-up, I was like, I've got nothing in my body to be able to do a good FTP. So I was like, I'm just not going to bother doing it. And then the next day, you know, had a bit more food in me as a, you know, not a big breakfast, but maybe some bananas and a bit of a snack just to kind of top up some glycogen levels for a short effort.
Yeah.
But just being aware of that as well. And obviously as coaches, we can understand that in ourselves, and we're just trying to get that across to your clients. But then that comes through experience and practice, I suppose, as well. So
I think when anybody does power tests and things like that, it's something that is automated pretty much with what we do. Is we make sure that in the run-up to the week beforehand, they're not trying to drive a hard calorie deficit, that they are in a position that when they hit that session, they should be well-rested, they should be well-fueled. They should be feeling that if they start that session, that they can do what you did, which is like, not today. You know, because there's no point in doing a horrendous, let's say 20 minute, lots of different sessions you can do, but 20 minute session and just grilling yourself silly. Because mentally, I think actually from a psychological perspective, that can ruin you for a while if you get it wrong, really wrong. And this is the problem with FTP tests. And this is kind of one of the reasons why I love AI, right? Because nowadays, you may not even ever have to test again if you get a decent software package, which is great. Because let's face it, who likes doing a 20-minute power test?
No, I'm a bit of a sick. I like the hard effort sometimes, so I quite like them. But what's your aspect just on that before we wrap things up, Simon? But what's your viewpoint on that when it comes to the FTP test in its old traditional state, and then you've got the new ramp test as well? And I know a few clients have utilized the, you know, the almost kind of almost like a VO2 max test FTP, isn't it? You're just increasing the power until you, you know, fatigue and fail. How do you think that compares in comparison to both?
Do you know what? It's such an individual question to the person that you're coaching and what they're trying to train for. Quite frankly, I quite like to potentially test everybody across the range, because sometimes it shows where they are the weakest. And I think if you test that maybe 4 times a year, to show them that they've improved. One of the things I love doing actually is maybe not testing FTP, but actually showing them that the FTP has got stronger and showing that they can hold that for longer. And that's quite a cool aspect. It's like, you didn't think you were that fit when you first started. And when you first started, you could hold FTP for 5 minutes. You know, so potentially maybe we are saying your FTP is wrong, but now you can hold that number, you can hold it for 20 minutes. And all of a sudden they look at themselves in a slightly different light. They've got that ability to keep suffering. They've learned that ability to hold a better cadence and a better power number. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's very individual to the person that you're coaching. You know, again, if you ask me to do a 20-minute FTP test, I've failed those so many times. Ask me to go up Sarcolobra, max effort. So this year when I did it, there were 10 people in front of me in the group that we were with. And the goal was, the guy said to me, your goal is try and beat everybody to the top. We're going to get you to go last, and your goal is trying to overtake everybody. And I remember thinking, oh, crikey, that's quite a big task. But actually, I quite like the challenge. It was like, let's give it a crack. And it gives me a focus. But what I'm really trying to say is, like, outside, when you've got wind running through your ears and you're really good, in my mind, that's where the test really comes into play. Inside, it's harder, I think, a lot harder. Again, go back to your original question. Test across the range and see where you're good and what you need to work on.
Yeah, there's a real difference of just looking at a screen for 20 minutes in a pain cave rather than actually being outside and just like knocking off the lamppost or the corner, each corner. And you know, the real difference. Exactly. Great. Simon, also just a few more questions before we wrap things up, but you mentioned AI there. Where would you, so one of our last questions for today's podcast, but where do you see the cycling evolving within the training in terms of AI? And you know, there's a lot more aspects, I suppose, of people must self-coaching, feeling they don't need a coach because they can maybe get access to programs through AI and stuff like that now. And there's a lot more apps that you can also download and use that. How do you feel that's going to come into play within coaching? And also,
I think there will always be people as well. Always people who will want to try and outskirt, you know, not have a coach because they see that as maybe money that they don't need to spend. But the same thing is, so you can be given way too much information. You can cherry pick wherever you like, and AI will maybe help you choose better. But anybody listening to this will understand that you and I understand the human aspect of it. AI will never do that. And having someone listening to what you're talking about, thinking about where we need to go next, maybe pulling you back or pushing you forward, is way more valuable in coaching and training, and also being able to help you make right decisions with sleep, nutrition, rest, recovery. AI at the moment is not going to help you with that. What it can do, and I think this is the exciting part of AI from our perspective, is it can potentially help us make better decisions with program writing, which means it's even better for the people that we coach, because we go, look, I think we should have gone this way, but with this algorithm, I think this is where we fall down short and we can use it to make it better. That's a really exciting aspect. And, you know, writing programs is a big part of what we do. It can take a lot of time to get that right. And having that AI aspect to help us make that easy and quicker, so we can talk more to our athletes and coach them better, is only a good thing in my mind. So, yeah, it's a double-edged sword. Some people may be like, well, I don't need a coach anymore. But I think the human aspect of coaching can't be replaced.
And do you think, just as a final question, do you think that comes down to also understanding the individual, but also the individual understanding themselves a bit better, rather than just being so focused on data? Because I think sometimes we can get way caught up in sleep trackers and other things to tell us that we're doing well, but actually you're not actually listening to your own body and helping you understand yourself better.
So I think sometimes people are obsessed so much about data that they lose sight of everything. And it might surprise you, though, they've not touched it, is that I use power on the turbo because I know that works and it keeps me true. It was only this year that I put on the BMC as a power crank. For the last 6 years, I've been just riding free on heart rate and just in and RPE. And it blew people's minds. So when I went up Circle Over, I didn't have a power meter on the BMC this year. And they were like, what was your power? I looked up and said, I have no idea. And they're like, what do you mean you have no idea? Did it turn off? And I was like, no, I don't have one. And they're like, wow, you rode that without a power meter. I was like, you don't need a power meter. If you really know what you're doing and you understand yourself and you're really in tune with yourself, I had heart rate. It was quite a warm day. But I know what I can put out physically. I know when I'm going too silly. And I'm experienced enough to understand my pacing. Could I do better with a power meter? Potentially, yes. But, you know, still post a decent time. So I think people get bogged down in data. And sometimes I think you can hold them back. You know, they go, well, this is my number. Like, well, actually, I think you could probably do a bit more. Or sometimes, you know, they're overcooking themselves. So, again, this is where AI won't help. And this is where someone with experience and someone who can ask them really good questions can figure out what's going on and change it for the better. Data is good, but it's not the be-all and end-all of life.
Yeah, I'm a big agreement with you there as well, Simon, because I've never had a power meter apart from when I'm training with one on Swift or in the gym. And I've played around with maybe getting a power meter and stuff, but then I don't want to, when I'm riding, I just want to be riding. I don't want to be looking at my Wahoo or my Garmin and just tracking what I'm doing. I mean, sometimes when I've done events like Ironmans and stuff, you're just monitoring your heart rate so you don't go in the red. Obviously, that's different. But my Garmin, unless I'm following a map, I turn it off so it goes off battery saver mode so I can't see it until I finish the ride. And you're just going on feel. I know when I'm riding hard, if I want to push hard on the climb, if I've gone too hard. Or I think that sometimes you forget. For me, anyway, you still get the enjoyment of being out and just riding for the enjoyment of it rather than just being so focused on numbers and then forgetting about why you're riding in the first place.
100%. You know, I have two aspects to my riding. It's like be specific, get fit, be strong, be powerful, go and ride your bike. Yeah. You know, I'm going to do that today. Like yesterday, I did hill reps up a horrendous hill, which is 16%. And someone wrote on my Strava, went, "You are crazy." And then today, I'm going to go and ride the bike and just go for a nice pedal. Just like literally, okay. Just go and go. Right, I'm going to go that way. You know, I know I'm going to ride for maybe a couple of hours, nice and steady, but I don't care where. I'm just going to go enjoy the fact that I'm on two wheels, a bit of wind in my ears, and just like just skipping along on a bike, nice and steady. You don't need a bike for that.
Nah. And you got North Devon. You live in North Devon, is that right?
Yeah, beautiful
countryside to ride around as well. So
it is one of the reasons why I moved, because we've done a flip. You've gone to London, I've moved to Devon.
Yeah.
And I moved here because I just couldn't handle the traffic anymore. And it is a delight to ride around here. You definitely become a climber if you live in Devon.
Yeah. Well, I am a climber. That's why I do pride myself on. I do love the climbs, and I've grew up in Devon, so Dartmoor is my playground. So anytime I'm back home, I bring the bike and get out for some rides for sure. So yeah,
good climbing. It's a good playground to play in. That's for sure.
Yeah. Definitely the climbs in London when I moved here, I improved my power on the flat. I used to get dropped on the flat all the time because I was never used to that sustained effort. But, you know, my all-round ability as a cyclist has improved based on riding with faster groups. And then the climbs aren't as – there's a few good challenging climbs in Kent, but not as much as you get in Devon's for sure. So, yeah, that's good fun. Yeah. But thank you, Simon. We'll wrap things up. Really enjoyed the conversation with you today, and you know, there's some really good nuggets that everybody can take home with themselves. If people want to get in touch with you or reach out to you and learn a bit more about what you do and maybe how you can help people, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I'll send you my links, but they can find me on Instagram with @velo_performance, and they can find me on YouTube with Velo Performance.
Perfect. Yeah, excellent. I'll put the links to all your social medias in the show notes as well, so everyone can access them.
Thank you.
But thanks very much for coming on the show. Really love chatting to you. Really good insight, and it's nice to have a good perspective of someone, you know, 40 plus, of how they're managing their body in a similar way, and you know, looking at the science behind that, not just, I know, hearsay, I suppose, when it comes to performance gains as we get older. So, yeah, really good.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.